Please, you know, leave it, you're just begging me. And I was saying, God, just to do this one more sentence, you know, I gotta finish this paragraph. I can't leave it now.
All other relations.
Oh God, it was terrible. And then I looked at the time, it was 12 o'clock Thursday night. We were supposed to have left at 4 or 5, you know. And there was no way that I was gonna leave it, even at that time. And I'd been writing straight for about 28 hours. I didn't sleep and I didn't eat.
So
and I was a mess. No, I was typing. I was a mess.
Yeah.
You know. Inside that world, you know, with Slash. But I couldn't leave him at that point. If I did, well, I felt that. I probably wouldn't have happened. But I felt that if I left him at that particular point, if I didn't get it down at that particular point, that I was going to lose the whole thing, and I just couldn't.
Sometimes it takes a long time to get back.
Yeah, and so I didn't, you know. Finally, I just said, look, I just can't. I just can't do it. I can't help it. I can't understand it, and I can't tell you about it. But you're just going to have to, you know, you're just going to have to accept it. And so we didn't go out that weekend. And he ended up, you know, forcing me to eat and forcing me to sleep some and rest some, you know, and get back to work on. But I remember the terror that it put me through, you know, the dredging up of those images. And as I said, there were things that we did cut out. There were things in that period that I didn't leave in the novel and didn't need to be there, but I had to work through myself. So I guess in terms of the novel itself, it was 4 years, 3.5 years. The final, you know, editing and stuff like that took about 6 months. Rewrites and stuff like that, cutting out and stuff. But 4 years for the novel. And I don't think it, for myself, it could be done in less time. Maybe something that I already knew about really well, I could do it in less time. If I knew the subject and everything, all the information, if I knew all of that stuff, you know, probably could do a novel in a year or something like that, the writing of it. But I still am fearful about doing a second one. I know I will, I know that. I know what it will be about, you know, because I've been working on this idea. I haven't found the courage yet to approach it. I haven't found the, it's not the time even, it's the space to, you know, to do it, to work at it. So I'm working at all these other things preliminary to it, or maybe part of that. But so it was about 4 years. The process, the working of it, was a learning process for me.
I guess you'd rather not talk about what it is that you're thinking about that you would like to write. You said when you're doing the research, you were also reading all literature by other native authors' novels. Are there some in particular that you found fascinating or that to you seemed unique or moved you?
Well, I'd read Lee Miracle's book before that. As I said, it was an influence in terms of my own thinking. And it had an effect and an impact on me. And Maria Campbell's While I Was Still at You that came out, and I remember when her book Half Breed came out, she was visiting in Victoria and we were interviewing her. I didn't get to talk to her, but she was on the radio, on the radio program, and she was talking. I remember, you know, listening and listening to her voice and listening to her thinking. And then going back to the novel and reading the, not the novel, but the book, and reading the book, and trying to imagine for her, you know, what it was like in terms of reading. And I think for me that half-read book was important book in terms of literature and English because of the way it was presented.
Any comments about authors from South of the border?
I didn't,
mentioned Harjo, but I mean Harjo is
later. It was later. At that particular time, that particular period, time period.
Where's Maria's essays?
You want me to shut this off or an interview? And mostly articles, political articles, stuff that was being written by people either in the movement or people against the movement.
I was thinking of Hannaday, Welsh, and Silko came out Ceremony in 78.
Yeah, I didn't read Leslie Silko until after after that. It wasn't up here in Canada. We just couldn't buy it in Canada. Or if we could, it was, you know, we just couldn't find it. But I had Red House Made of Dawn, and I read that, there was another one by Mamadi, The Way to Rainy Mountain, is that what it's called? Yeah, The Way to Rainy Mountain.
About the Kailua, three levels.
And I was very, very intrigued by it. I still am. I'm a great admirer of Mamadi's writing. But James Welsh I didn't read at that particular period in time. And I don't think it was because he was unavailable, it's just that I hadn't heard about James Welsh until much later when I was reading, when I was saying I was reading for the research part,
it's
mainly historical stuff. I was reading all kinds of newspaper accounts and Indian newspaper accounts and Indian commentaries, political stuff. But I was looking at the political growth and history of people rather than literature.
Howard Adams?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad about everybody who knows
him. And since then, though, I've been doing, I guess, more appropriate reading in terms of literature and looking at development of literature, the development of Native literature, and the development of Native voice, and how various people have approached it. And in particular, I guess I'm really, really concentrating on poetry. I've really had my mind focused on poetry, I guess, in the last 5 years or 4 years, since Slash. And I've really been reading a lot of poetry, concentrating more on poetry. Just recently I've been looking at short stories, but I'm so afraid of that form of writing yet at this point that I haven't approached it. I've submitted one short story to Thomas King's new thing that's coming up, and he's accepted it, but I'm so afraid of that format. Because it's not as easy as telling a story. From my point of view, the Native short story differs in a really fundamental way from what we understand short story to be. And I've seen examples of Native short story, good examples of Native short story. And I'm excited about that format. But I don't know enough about it. I don't know enough about it to
You know this little anthology, The Man to Send Rain Clouds?
Yes.
That title story.
Oh,
it's
I know.
Wonderful.
I know. That's one of the books that turned me on. Native short story. And what I need to do, what I need to do is for myself to do some critical thinking around short story. In the same way that I've been doing with my poetry, Native poetry. And novels.
Having heard you read your poetry the other night and then on tape, you should always write poetry and read it.
I'm publishing a book of poems this year. A collective
version. Possible it should be also made available in sound, because you've got a way of reading that. very precise, but also very mellow and soft. It sounds very
good. Thank you. Did you get the second tape? We have three tapes that I gave you. I gave you one, and you have.
Poetry is not the fun.
Poetry is not a luxury.
Poetry is not a luxury, right? Mm-hmm. And I got that at the shop over there. Mm-hmm. Then I got
Theft of Paradise.
Right.
Oh, okay. You've got all mm-hmm. three now, because I just gave you the last one. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's one John Wayne. Something with John Wayne. There's
I'm not on that one.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
The Death of John Wayne.
Because mm-hmm. I saw that. That's a nice story. It's also a story about nuclear pollution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, shall we talk in open?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I was really excited when I got a flyer from, I think, from a friend in Lethbridge about an Oka.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was sent from here.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, I must go there and check that out, because mm-hmm. it's the first program of this kind. I'm mm-hmm. only, otherwise, I'm unaware of the School of Native Journalism,
mm-hmm.
University of Western Ontario, where Alan Chris Johnson
mm-hmm.
I talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really new.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you pull this together? Because I understand mm-hmm. that it's mainly you who's pulling it together.
Well, it's a natural progression
mm-hmm.
from my point of view, mm-hmm. not from everybody else's point of view. It's like, what are you doing? Wow! But from my point of view, it's a natural progression out of what the work was in terms of the Inalkin Center, what it was involved with, and what it has been originally set up to be. You know, if you look at the objectives of the society which governs Inalkin, the objectives of the society is to record and perpetuate and promote Native in a cultural sense, in education and in our lives and in our communities. And it sounds pretty open-ended, but in terms of Inalkin itself, in terms of its evolving and its growth, it has always been in the area of words, and in the words of I don't know who it was, Jeff Smith or whatever. We've always been involved in passing on
mm-hmm.
of information,
mm-hmm.
correct as possible to those people who require that information, whether they're our children, our own people, or school teachers, or whatever. And that was always the essence of Inalkin. For the curriculum project, which was the original founding reason for it, was to develop curriculum for school children
mm-hmm.
That carried the history and the content in a correct way, in a dignified way, for use in the school, so that Okanagan kids could read the history of who their people were
mm-hmm.
and be proud of that, proud of the contributions, and be proud as an Okanagan person. So that part of the founding of the Inalkin Center was called the Okanagan Indian Curriculum Project.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of research and a lot of writing and a lot of involvement of the Native people, the elders of our communities, and saying, yeah, that's what's important, and that's
mm-hmm.
how it should be presented, and that's correct, the correctness of it was always a part of the process. And I guess the second part of the process that in terms of just the putting together the information and delivering it was the importance of Native people, our own people, doing that work. And that was always one of the ingredients that we insisted on whenever we did a project. And that came right from the start. It was a political battle right from the start. Because when we met with the school districts about the production of the curriculum for the schools, right away they wanted to hire non-Indian researchers, anthropologists, historians, and they wanted to hire non-Indian writers and coordinators and so on, to make sure that the information was going to be good enough to be used in their schools. And you know, they're not intention to be paternalistic, but that's what it turns out to be.
Sure.
And that's it, saying you people can't do that. You don't know your own history, you don't know how to write, you don't know how to research, you don't know how to put material together that's useful or usable. And for myself, that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And will always be unacceptable. So a part of the agreement that we have with each other in terms of the Cricket Project, because I was on the founding committee,
mm-hmm,
for the Resources Society, it was called the Okanagan Tribal Education Committee at that,
mm-hmm,
time, was we said, no, we're not going to agree with that. The only correct version has got to be from our people. Nobody else can give the correct version but our people,
mm-hmm,
and we're going to stick with that. So if that means training our people in terms of researching and in terms,
mm-hmm,
of producing information, in terms of developing information and ways to do that, then that's what we'll have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that if the stuff doesn't come out for 10 years, we're gonna work it that way so that the stuff comes out in its quality,
mm-hmm,
and it's correct and it's appropriate. And most of all, it's Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something that at the outset was a real clear path in terms,
mm-hmm,
of how we were to organize and how we were to work. And so we've kept that as a guiding force, I guess, is,
mm-hmm,
that always when we had a project in front of us in which we were going to produce something, that Native people be the people,
mm-hmm,
that were involved in doing that. And so the natural outgrowth of that in terms of all the other training that we do in Anoka, beyond the curriculum project, we developed the Learning Institute, in which we were we became a training center,
mm-hmm,
for adult people, adult natives, giving them skills in writing and,
mm-hmm,
history and background,
mm-hmm,
life skills and all those things. We could see that we lack resources, we lack skilled people that have the training that's necessary, the basic,
mm-hmm,
and fundamental education and training that's needed to produce and do certain things. And so we ended up becoming a training center to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, Thetis, as a part of the curriculum,
mm-hmm,
project, came into being. And out of that, those two dynamics there, in terms of training people, in terms of Thetis as a,
mm-hmm,
publisher, needing people who could edit and write,
mm-hmm,
and typeset, and people who could,
mm-hmm,
contribute, it was a question of, okay, where do we get these people from? You know, where do we find these people? Who's training these people?
Mm-hmm.
Where in the hell in the country do you find a school which talks about Native literature, Native,
mm-hmm,
genre, Native voice? And where the heck do you get people who can be skilled in those areas to edit,
mm-hmm,
to publish, to write, to script, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There is no place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are doing it in a hit-and-miss method on their own and going through great pains to reach skill areas in one,
mm-hmm,
area, maybe. And you have them all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to us just a natural outgrowth of that question that Thetis had in front of them. Well, if there aren't those people around and there's no place they can go, the thing,
mm-hmm,
we have to do is develop a situation in,
mm-hmm,
which people can gain those skills,
mm-hmm,
in which people can collectively work together, and we can have Native people who have a variety of skills that can plug into those areas, not just for our needs here, but in their,
mm-hmm,
communities,
mm-hmm,
out there, for schools and for universities, for their own children and for the non-Native people.
This is really,
mm-hmm,
as I see it, a development from the bottom up.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And not from,
mm-hmm,
as it happens in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
People went to university,
mm-hmm,
stayed mainly at the,
mm-hmm,
university level as teachers of,
mm-hmm,
English or American,
mm-hmm,
literature,
mm-hmm,
who are Native persons in that,
mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they're,
mm-hmm,
touched down, but this,
mm-hmm,
is, this comes,
yeah, it
from
comes
the
from
people.
The community need.
Yes.
It comes from a real gap there, a real gap in terms of not having those people to fill those gaps. And so I don't have any fears about the success of the school and the outcomes in terms of the writers themselves. But like any new thing, it's,
mm-hmm,
it's not something that's just going to, you know, explode the moment it starts. And we realize that, and I have enough experience in the working of in Alcan, in the building of this institute here. I have enough experience to know that that it's perseverance and that it's work and that it's your heart, you know, that matters and how things are going to be successful. And nothing comes easy that's good.
Do you think an Alcan could function without you? I mean, the writer's problem? Because I don't, I can't imagine that it could. I know about how it was set up. I should also mention that when I got this booklet on an Alcan, I also got some torn out of somewhere job description, and I thought, oh, that seems a job that was Janet Armstrong, from what I knew about Anne Hebert. And somebody sent it to me because I'm always looking for jobs. I know that my future in Germany is like that. But
That's really a strange one because it never was my intention. It never occurred to me to teach the writing school programs. I wanted to be a part of it in terms of some of the workshopping because I know that I have done some thinking and some research, and I have some understanding around what some of those questions I bring up about native voice and the native in literature. And
that's what I mean. If you are here and it is from this community, you are the sort of the link between the teaching program in native writing and the community.
I guess, you know, what I'm saying is it never occurred to me that was the way it was. What I saw is that we could set up the program, we could bring in a coordinator, a native person, a person like Joy Harder or a person like Thomas King or other native people who have the academic credentials would come in and would act as a coordinator, would also act as an instructor and bring in other writers in residence. That's how it was set up. It wasn't set up so that I would teach the program. I really actively wanted to take the time off to write. That was my intention, was to, you know, set this thing up, take the time off to write, and do some part-time workshopping with the program. But really,
so that would be your ideal for the future? Or would you rather?
That's my ideal for the future. I'll tell you my ideal for the future. That's my ideal for myself.
Yes.
As a, you know, as an individual. But what happened this past year was when we sat down collectively, the writers that we brought together to look at the curriculum, to look at the focus, the objectives and the outcomes, the learning that we wanted to happen for the students, the facilitation of that. What happened was I began to see some of the things that you just mentioned, that it was going to be important to have someone who knew what they were talking about. And it was important to have someone who had already done some thinking around that and some research and so on, and could, you know, could articulate it. And there's pieces of that in all of us as writers. There's pieces that are lacking in me, there's pieces that are lacking in others. But one of the things that when we send out this thing, you know, to hire a coordinator, instructor, is that we just couldn't find anyone who's a public. We got a lot of response from both Native people and non-Native people.
And I know it's handled together with Dean Rick, Dirk Wyman.
Yeah.
I met him actually last Saturday, but I don't know if I spoke very highly with great expectations.
He was one of my instructors at UW.
Yeah, he told me.
And so what happened is we went through the applications, the people that we wanted for the position. There were three Native people that you know, gave us resumes that we wanted, any one of those three. At the final end, decided not to do it for various reasons. It wasn't just for one reason, but for various reasons. Couldn't couldn't come to the program. So that left us in the position of making a choice between those others who made applications who didn't quite fit that profile.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So I guess it should be understood that there isn't just me, you know, that can fill this profile. It could operate without me, but it would have to be coordinated more closely. And I think that, you know, the writers, the way that the writers in residence are structured, if there's a clear path for them to work through, and for the writers to be able to relate from one workshop to the next, that's important, and I think that could be accomplished without me. The plan for it is in place, and we all workshopped that. That didn't belong just to me. There was Lee, Miracle, and Margot Kane, and Minnie Freeman, and Joy Harjo, Don Fiddler, and Henry Michelle, the guy there with the pink shirt. We all sat down and worked very hard at the thinking. And it's not true that, you know, that couldn't operate and function without me. This year, probably that's true. But in terms of the school itself, I don't agree with that, and I don't think that that's true. This year in particular, because we couldn't find an instructor, I stepped in to instruct with an agreement with the University of Victoria that I would only be doing it on that basis, that, until we got an instructor for it, that I would act as a coordinator. I would do some instruction, but I would rely on other writers to fill in those gaps. And so that's what was agreed on, and I'm comfortable with that, and I like doing it, and I like covering that ground. And I also did at this summer when I went to FAST in June. I was very concerned about the appropriate person coming to the program and being the instructor for the first year. And so when I went through that ceremony, I asked for that. I said, we really need the right person that's going to make this program become alive and real, and give it the strength that it requires to continue the next year, and because of the importance of it, you know, for our people, and for all of our communities, and for all of mankind, in terms of what the contributions can be made by Native writers. And I was really sincere about that. I really, really prayed for and asked for the right person. And it never dawned on me until Don Fiddler went down to Victoria and met with Dirk and came back, and they said, well, we talked about this whole thing about the instructors, and we're not satisfied. Once those three people that we wanted declined, we were not satisfied with those, and we think you're the best person for it. And I was flabbergasted. I mean, I really was. I sat here and I couldn't say anything. I didn't know what to say to Don. I just said, well, all I can say is I'm overwhelmed. You know, I'd never thought about it, and it never occurred to me. And I really have to be honest in saying that, because I was praying so hard for this right person, right?
Yeah.
And he said, well, obviously you're the right person. You know, you're the right person. You have to do it this year. And this was like maybe 2 weeks after I came back from my fast, and I was expecting some magical person to land here, you know. So it was strange. It was a strange occurrence. And I went back that night and I talked to my dad and my mom. And they said, well, when you pray, you know, when you pray for things, if you pray with a sincere mind, you know, you never really can presume or understand what and how those things are answered. But it's obvious to us, you know, that you got what you asked for. And then they laughed, you know, it's a joke. And they said, be careful what you pray for, you know.
Sure, because you don't pray for yourself, do you?
Yeah.
So, what are your...
Well, I think you've answered that, what your dreams for the future are for nothing.
Is there something that you would like to add, if I play this to students or try to disseminate it in Europe, that you'd like to say across the internet?
Sure. I guess one of the things that I'm very, very, very concerned about, one of the things that I'm really fearful of is the state that humanity is in right now. And I'm really fearful of it because of the dehumanization process that has been happening to our people. And you can talk about governments and bureaucracies and so on, and all of those things act on it, but beyond that, it's a loss of our basic humanity through, a twisted ideal in terms of what quality and life and living is all about. And it's become evident in terms of the natural world around us and what it looks like. The sickness of us as human beings has become evident in the destruction of the world, the destruction of our atmosphere and our life form and our rivers and our lakes. And it's not a natural occurrence. It's not a natural outgrowth. And what I see happening is the disease that's there in terms of man is not a disease of the earth. It's a disease of our spirit, a disease that's killing us. Mm-hmm. And the disease that we're not doing anything about. And it's not a matter of making more laws or more legislations mm-hmm. or political actions, as Lee was saying. It's not a matter of that. We can fight for, you know, taking nuclear weapons out of there, cleaning up the rivers and stuff like that. But what we need to talk about and what we need to look at is our humanness, our compassion and our love, and how we need to rebuild, how we need to put that back together so we can come back to wholeness and health, you know, so we can be what we were meant to be, you know, as a healthy human population. And it's frightening and fearful to watch that process. It's frightening and fearful to turn on the television, to read the newspapers. It's frightening and fearful every day. For, you know, me as a Native person to see that process, you know. It's like a horror story, you know. You're sitting in the middle of a horror story when you know things could be different, you know. When you know things could be like the paradise that people describe, you know. And it's so sad, and it's so frightening, and it's so terrible. And I don't know how to put that across. And to me, it's important that Native people be brought back to health. It's important for me, as a necessary process for all of people, that Native people be brought back to that process, because it's there that I've been able to see health and wholeness in spirit. You know, wholeness in spirit, mm-hmm. in terms of spirituality, in balance with all of the other things. And it's there that I know that the work has to be done among all of us. And it's there that Native people's words and their thinking and their processes and their systems and their philosophy, worldview or whatever, needs to be understood and looked at and assimilated by other people. And it's so important and it's so critical and it's so necessary, because we all deserve the happiness and the joy and the cleanness and the purity, mm-hmm. you know, that we could be. We all deserve that. And we're being left as bereft, you know, by our own actions, by our own unthinking, as Lee says. And that's what I see is important between us. From, you know, other countries of the world, between us, the basic love of each other and all things around us being the most important thing that we need to talk about, that we need to bring back to life. Mm-hmm. That's what I see. Tonight, I sit here up at Flint Rock and look down to the thousands of lights spread out in the distance, where the town is creeping incessantly up the hillsides. Across the Okanagan Valley, the sun begins to set. Blazes of Mars red tinged with deep purple and crimson, brushed silvery clouds and touched the mountain tops. The wind moans through the swaying pines as coyotes shrill their songs to each other in the gathering dusk. Long yellow grasses bend and whip their blades across cactus, sand, and sage. I feel old, and I think I have seen many things for a young person. I have made my stand and chosen my path, and I decide to tell my story for my son and those like him because I must. My reason is simple. Under the cruel blows of the harsh one, some call destiny, many of our people have shuddered and fallen. Few have accepted his teacher and taken her gifts. To those that do, defeat is a stranger and pain an everyday reality. Some shall call them leaders. Let me kiss your footprints in the grass. I have been a warrior because I suffer. Let me pray. Though a tree falls and dies, or dies and falls, let its flowers not perish, but spread and scatter in the chill dance that is kin to sky. Let me open my way among grasses. I carry your seed. The wind will wipe out little traces of you.